Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Advocacy Learning Center's Affinity Discussion. Today, we are joined by teams from Class F, G, and H. So we have a big group. Welcome out there. My name is Beth McNamara, and I will be the moderator for today's call. This is the second Affinity Discussion in our three-part series, Exploring Shelter Rules. And as always, the Affinity Discussions are calls that provide a format where we hope we can have an energizing dialogue among each other, with each other, to all, you know, we do this with the caveat that we recognize that being on the phone and being in a muted line delays that dialogue a little bit, but as you know, we've tried to mitigate as much background noise as possible so that everybody has a good quality sound during the call. So we've had to try to balance that a little bit. But we hope that you will engage during the call and share your comments, your thoughts, your questions, all of those pieces, because that's how we've structured this call is really much less like our strategy sessions and more like a conversation with everyone. So to do that, we'll remind you a couple of times during the call, and you probably have all heard these instructions, but you push star 1, and Shane, our operator, will get you into the question queue, which just means that he'll mitigate being able to move you from your muted line to your unmuted line and do that with as much ease and seamless transition as possible. So just to let you all know, besides Class F, G, and H, who else is on this call? We have Liz and Diane and Sandy from Praxis on the line. And Liz has just a few little logistics that she's going to share with us, and then we'll move on and start digging in. Liz?
Thank you, Beth, and hi, everybody. It's good to be back with you again. So just a couple of quick reminders for how this call will function. As Beth said, we do encourage you at any time to share your comments or thoughts with us, and so don't hesitate to do that either by pressing star 1 and getting into the question queue of the operator or sending an email to Liz at Praxis International, and we will do our best to make space in the discussion for your comment and your question right away. You can also use that same email address, liz@praxisinternational.org. If you have any technology issues, be sure to let me know. Finally, this session is being recorded and will be available on the protected class page of the ALC website, and so don't hesitate to go back and revisit this discussion with your coworkers or your colleagues who perhaps weren't able to join us today. So that's all I have, Beth.
Great. Thanks, Liz. Okay, so when we started shaping up this affinity discussion series, we were thinking about what it is that we want to bring up for topic of conversation, we realized that a big issue that bubbled up and has been bubbling up for years and years and continues to be kind of one of those conversations that I have a lot with participants of the ALC and the struggles and the critical thinking elements and all of those moments of pause, a lot of those moments for folks were around shelter rules. And so we thought it was just finally time for us to spend some dedicated time with each other thinking through shelter rules and all the struggles that we've been having and, you know, just really starting to dig in. And it also became really clear to us as we were thinking this through this topic that it also really illustrates many of the social change advocacy principles that we focus on in the ALC. So it gives us this moment where we can finally just think it through together. So that's how we came up with this series, why we came up with it, and why we've dedicated 3 calls to it. And by asking questions about shelter rules, like where do shelter rules come from and why, which rules are mandated and which are optional. We have just endless conversations and thinking points about what it is that we're going to do with all this as a way to move through how we're going to finally come to a place where we're strengthening our advocacy and really working towards social change. as we noted in our first session, shelter rules are, you know, often very well intentioned attempts to prevent bad or harmful events from happening. But we also know, and what you're sharing with us and what all of our experiences have been, that it doesn't come without struggles. And time and time again, rules often kind of unnecessarily limit a lot of freedoms. They have a lot of unintended consequences. And, you know, what we also know is that for me personally, and you could probably share a little bit of this, it's given me a lot of premature wrinkles, a lot of agita, sleepless nights. You know, it's just one of those things that just gets us going. So that's where we started with this. In our first discussion, for those of you who weren't able to join us for the first session of this series, we had Anne Menard, who's the Executive Director of the National Resource Center on Domestic Violence, lead us through a discussion on shelter rules. And she led us through a discussion. She first gave this really nice historic perspective on the topic, and then she started pulling out threads and common things that were identified in a recent study that she was engaged with on meeting survivors' need, which was a multi-state study of DV, domestic violence experiences. If you weren't able to join us for that series, we did record that call. It's on the Class Protected page, and it's just there for you to listen to whenever you get a chance. You can find that there. So the other thing that we wanted to tell you is that a part of this series, Anne was very kind to mail a hard copy of How the Earth Didn't Fly Into the Sun, the Missouri's Project to Reduce Rules in Domestic Violence Shelters, to all of you. And this publication describes Missouri's extensive examination of shelter rules and recommendations. And as luck would have it, we have two women from the Missouri Coalition who are going to be able to start diving into that publication. So if you all had a chance to look at it after you it arrived in your mailbox, or if you haven't had a chance to look at it yet, this might be the time where you're going to start digging through it in piles on your desk. They have a ton of really good stuff to share with us on kind of that experience of going through that process in Missouri. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce our two lovely guests who have so graciously given their time to be with us. Jennifer Carter-Dockler has worked in the movement to end violence against women since 1997. Her experience in Texas and Missouri includes advocating with victims of domestic and sexual violence, research, community organizing, and education, along with program development in campus and community-based programs. Jennifer joined the Missouri Coalition staff in 2003 and first started as program specialist and then became the education coordinator in 2010, and then she became the education outreach coordinator in 2011. Along with Jennifer, we also have Laura Zahand, who has been advocating for survivors in domestic violence since 1995. Laura joined the Missouri Coalition staff in 2003 as the program development specialist, and she also has worked in shelter as the children's program coordinator. She has served on numerous boards that are active in advocating for children victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and other victims of crime. So we have a wealth of experience with us on the line. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're glad to be here.
Very good. So here's how we're going to get us started. Is we thought it would be nice to just have Jennifer and Laura get us started by perhaps just giving us just a little bit of information about Missouri and the coalition work that you are doing there, to give us a little bit of grounding, and then we'll carry through with our conversation.
Sure. So we're just going to tell you a little bit about the state of Missouri, just so you have a context of it. We have a population of just under 6 million. There's 114 counties plus the city of St. Louis, so that's a little different. We've got the city of St. Louis plus the county of St. Louis, so the city is separate. Most of our programs identify as being fairly rural. Our big urban areas are St. Louis and Kansas City. But many of our programs are rural and identify as dual domestic and sexual violence programs.
This is Laura. We have approximately 56 domestic violence shelters in the state of Missouri. And just a little idea about kind of services that were provided this last year. We had those programs provided well over 350,000 bed nights to over 10,300 and so men, women, and children. And then also, unfortunately, had to turn away almost 19,000 people because the shelters themselves were full. We also have over 100 programs just across the state. So that includes domestic violence shelters, but also rape crisis centers, the dual programs, prosecutor-based advocates, law enforcement-based advocates, so on and so on. Our state, what we've done for many, 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 many years is we have split the state up into 7 regions. And so when Jennifer started the coalition as a program development specialist and what I also do here, we are each assigned various regions. And so we do regional meetings that in most of those areas, at a minimum it's quarterly, but for the most part it's every other month. And so a representative from the coalition goes, and those programs that are in those regions, they meet. We do program updates. There's a training element involved with that, but it is also a way for them to network with each other and really not feel so isolated. So that's really how we've just basically how we work with programs at, like I said, that very basic level. As far as our projects with this project, but also just in general, how we've started working more and more is what we've kind of dubbed the Missouri model, which started before this project. It was actually around documentation and the whole documenting our work project that was going on several years back. And it was bringing programs together and really a problem had, you know, whatever the issue, whatever the challenge that was identified by advocates from across the state, and then bringing advocates together that are from different regions that represent urban and rural, you know, that we get a good mix around the state, and really having them get together and talk about some solutions, talk about what might work, what is not working, and it's a very organic process. And we've done that around documentation. We've done it around language access, some prevention work, dual programs. We continue to find that to be really effective. And the Shelter Rules Project was another one of those.
And so coalition staff provide support in the meetings. We organize the logistics. Some of them we've been able to provide mileage and space, and then we create some sort of documentation of that process for other programs to be able to use as a resource. And then when additional programs who weren't in those projects have assistance questions, they can call us, they can call any of the programs involved. So that way they're getting a lot of opinions and experience about the topic.
That's a little bit about Missouri.
So now we call it the Missouri model. Just it tends to be very pragmatic. That's part of kind of the culture we identify here in Missouri. And, you know, we're the show me state because there is a legislator in our past who has stood up on the floor and has said, you know, I'm from Missouri, you've got to show me. So being able to give really just practical tools and examples about any of these areas, and shelter rules is just another example.
And just one more thing kind of about the coalition. We actually, for as many programs as we have across the state of Missouri, we're actually a fairly small coalition because there's only 14 staff. 4 of those are program development folks, Jennifer that does the training and outreach, education training and outreach. We have some administrative staff, but, I mean, it's a staff of 14.
Yeah, a lot of work by a very few number of people.
Which is common to most programs around the country.
Yes, it's really quite unfortunately very common. So, but thank you very much for just giving us this little glimpse, because I think it's really incredibly helpful just to get a scope of kind of, as we dive into this project in particular, how you organized yourselves and you know, how, where you locate yourselves and all of those pieces of who had a part of this project. And then also, just for me personally, I see the Missouri model language all over the place, and it's never really been described so nicely before. So thank you personally for kind of helping out with that. So I always wonder what that means. So that's good. All right, so... Now that I shared with you, Anne had sent everybody how the Earth didn't fly into the sun. Manual, hard copy of the manual, and there, it's also, you know, available obviously online. If you just quick Google it, it'll come up as well. So if you're trying to dust off your hard copy and you're not coming up with it because you have too many piles on your desk, that might be also an option. But let's start rolling up our sleeves and talking about it. So would you mind just doing just a little bit of an overview of the project, so that we can start digging in?
Sure. This is Laura. You know, this project really started, I think, probably the moment the first shelter was ever opened. We just didn't know it had started. Because really, from the beginning of that first shelter opening its doors, there were discussions about rules. And I know that Anne did talk a little bit about that history. But what we continued to hear repeatedly over the years were advocates, frontline advocates, and their frustrations with rules. And we heard things about the exact same rules over and over and over and over again. We're having issues over and over and over again. It wasn't just one program that was struggling with chores or with a curfew or with how somebody supervised their child. I mean, it was over and over again the same rules, same issues.
And we had had a Foundations for Effective Advocacy training that we had held for a number of years, and we always included training on minimal rules and reducing rules, and yet we continued to have similar conversations. And so through a course of a number of different actions, we wondered, you know, how could we change that conversation? And that's where kind of regional meetings become really important, as well as the relationship we have with our members. We had had a member call who had been at the program quite a while and had worked through a process of reducing rules at that program, and then a new executive director came on who didn't understand and started re-implementing the rules. And she had called, the staff person had called to ask if we could go to regional meetings talking about rule reduction. And part of in the next call when we talk about strategies for implementation, from leadership to frontline, that's part of why it's so important, because here was a program who had reduced rules and was now going back to a similar place. And so that's when we started bringing this discussion back to regional meetings.
Yeah, and so what we were hearing at those regional meetings, beyond that we just have the same problems with the same rules, was it was the things like the inconsistent use of rules, you know, and I mean, I think we've all experienced it, have worked in shelter, you know, some survivors who may be like, you know, I'm going to wait for that person to come on that shift because I actually can talk with them and maybe they're, you know, I can get what I need from that person, but I'm going to wait until they get on shift. And, you know, when you talked a little further about it, it was maybe that person was not as structured when it came to the rules or something like that. Advocates continually expressed that they were feeling like the rules police, and that is not why they started this work. That's not what they thought was going to happen. They felt bad about things like having to write someone up. My hope is that writing someone up has become much more of a practice of the past, but I know when I started working in shelter, that was definitely something that was still going on. Somebody broke a rule, you write them up, they get however many of those things, and then you're going to ask them to leave, regardless of what they were written up for. There was also just, you know, the idea of, well, we have all these rules, but quite honestly, so many people don't follow them anyway, so why do we have them? So there were, it did not come because coalition staff really stayed up late at night trying to figure out how can we mess with programs. Hey, I know, let's mess with their rules. This came directly from advocates that were doing the direct service work right then. So, again, those conversations took place at regional meetings. Around the same time, I really kind of like to call this the perfect storm, because around the same time, there was also a set of articles that the Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence put out, and there was at least one or two programs that specifically were looking at rural reduction. One in particular is a YWCA out there that I talked with some of the staff there when we were starting our project, and it was things even about the physical structure of a program. Can you do some things that might change so that you could reduce some rules? And so I know that Washington State, I would highly recommend going to their website because they've got so much good information out there. And they've spent a lot of time on, again, physical structures of things as well. There was also a shelter power and control wheel that had come out that really did kind of examine some of our rules that were pretty common and how that really kind of could link to a survivor maybe feeling like this place almost has an extension of what I just came from, even though it was not intentional. And I want people to hear that. We know this was never, that was never anyone's intent. Ever.
We have a former, this is Jennifer, we have a former coworker who remembers when she first started a domestic violence shelter. You know, sometimes people are in so need to have somebody hired and in place. She didn't get a lot of training. She got, you know, the rule book, and it was very easy for her to understand her job that way. And so she became known as the warden there. And she never totally felt good about it, but it was the easiest way for her to understand at the time what her job was to be. And so some of it just becomes of us being overwhelmed sometimes and not sure how to handle situations where some of the rules evolve. And although we didn't use it at the time of the project, I do think it's important to point out at a similar time was in the homeless trauma work. They were also looking at rules reduction, and that becomes stuff that we started to rely later on. We just didn't know about it at the time of the project. So it wasn't just even domestic violence shelters starting to look at rules and the impacts of trauma. It was also what homeless shelters were starting to see and realizing that for individuals who have been so traumatized, how rules can really exacerbate what's been happening.
Yeah, and so, you know, all of this stuff was coming together, and we had programs in Missouri that were already having these conversations within their organizations. And so we knew of at least two or three that really were starting to truly examine their rules. And are, you know, do we have an organization and do we have practice and policy and procedures that are truly survivor defined, that truly are trauma informed? And so we had some programs that were really just ready for this anyway. And then I do kind of have to make fun of things happen like this, I think, often, but we don't really talk about this part of it. There was a really long car ride involved with this project. And our COO, Cheryl Rob Welch, who, by the way, deserves the credit for naming the publications, that became the mantra of that group of people because it's like, what's the worst thing that happened? You know, try this. It's not like the earth is going to fly into the sun or anything. And Cheryl and I were coming back from southeast Missouri, so it was at least a 4 to 5 hour car ride. And it had been after one of the regional meetings around rules, and we started talking, and it really did become, could you actually have a shelter with no rules? And it was a conversation on the way home. Of course, they don't let Cheryl and I ride together anymore because we just come up with projects. But, no, I mean, don't underestimate the conversations that you have and where those can lead. And I know that part of, you know, part of all of this that we do anyway – or part of what you all are doing is, you know, you're being able to have those conversations and being able to kind of critically think things through and just, absorb all of that and hopefully you can take some of those ideas that come out of it and just go with it.
Yeah. You know, I'm so glad that you talked a little bit about the shelter power and control wheel. When I first found this manual online, I don't know, a while back, I started reading it and just, you know, I couldn't get enough, like read and read and read and read. It's so content rich. And when I got to the power and control wheel, bubbles up pretty early on in the manual, if I remember correctly. And I just sat with this huge lump in my tummy when I got to that place because, you know, it just became so obvious when I read those examples that, you know, this this can feel not so good, and we also are trying to balance that with recognizing and understanding that we didn't, none of us set out to cause further harm.
Absolutely. This is Jennifer. I mean, our movement is still fairly young, and so we've been learning as we go. You know, the cycle of violence was huge when it first came out because we didn't have another way of explaining domestic violence, and now we tend to use the power and control wheel more. So we're continuing to learn what works, how we can grow, and it's never to make people feel bad, but I think it does happen when you look back on your own practice of things you might regret. But just normalize, we're still learning as our movement grows about what are effective services, what's the best way to offer our services. You know, like the Anne Menard study, it was the first study of that kind to really, on that magnitude, to get that sort of feedback from folks, which is huge.
Yeah, exactly. And so the only reason I bring that up is just to give us all permission to say we didn't come to this place to create further harm. And we also, I think, as a part of growing and learning,
absolutely,
and critically thinking about it, is that we do have to be willing to think through how we got to this place and where we all are in doing our advocacy work, and not be quick to say yes, but, or be really defensive about, well, we have this rule in place because it has to be here, because if we don't, then this happens. And so to just give you permission throughout the rest of our conversation, the rest of this series, to try really hard to suspend your yes, buts, and just perhaps let it percolate for a little while about what are other possibilities. As I think for me personally, when I get to a yes, but, or try really hard to defend something that, you know, I put it in place sometimes when I was thinking through, oh, my gosh, how did we get here? Like, well, I wrote it, and that wasn't good. I have to own it. But, you know, it's one of those moments where I think if we try to suspend that, we can open up a lot of possibilities. So I'm glad you brought it up. Okay, so I want to just give people a chance on the line. If anybody wants to, if whatever's percolating your minds, to share, to talk through anything at this point before we get any further. So if you have something to share, you can push star 1 as an option to get into the call, or the other option is to also do the email to liz@praxisinternational.org, and I can get your question in that way. So, Shane, is there any burning question, comment?
There is no question at this time.
Okay, lovely. Thanks. Okay, so don't hesitate. Oh, actually, I do have one question that just came in. I'm just going to take a pause. The manual that I keep mentioning and that Jennifer and Laura are talking about, I'm going to give the title once more because people, it looks like people are trying to Google it to get it up. So it's How the Earth Didn't Fly Into the Sun, Missouri's Project to Reduce Rules in Domestic Violence Shelters. So if you pop that into your Google search engine, that should come up, and it's a rather long PDF, but it is available online. Okay, so let's, and keep, you know, if you have other questions or things that are coming up for you all, please do push star 1. Okay, so let's just talk a little bit more about how you went about organizing the project, how you got it started, where you went after the long car ride.
Sure. This project is a little bit different than some of the other Missouri model projects in that, and it was a lesson learned. We started off calling it a pilot, which that turned into trauma for a whole lot of programs.
A lot of rumors.
Yeah, of like, oh my gosh, the coalition's going to take all of our rules away. I mean, it really became, so a lesson learned was never called a pilot. We just should always call things projects. But what we did, what we do now is we actually have people that apply when we put something like this together, is they actually apply. And we, because we want to make sure they have at least potentially the capacity to even start and maintain a project. So we didn't do that for this one, what we did, we knew the programs that were kind of ready, we thought. So we made contact with one program from each region. So they were both urban and rural. The smallest program that participated was 10 beds. The largest had 75 beds.
And that was at that time. That
yes.
Current program is still implementing, and now they're over 100 beds.
There were also, we wanted to make sure that as diverse as we could make these programs, we wanted that. So there were also various just physical structures. There were programs who, the most of the programs are like, it'd be a shelter under one roof. There was one program in which they are, they're almost connected apartments. It's almost like a strip mall is what my head's telling me. But they're apartments, but the shelter itself, it's in a public housing section is what it is. And so there is an apartment that is the shelter offices, and then there are two or three other apartments that are used for the shelter. So you don't necessarily have just one family in those apartments. I mean, you could have multiple people in those. The other program is probably the most unique one that I've at least come across. I know it's the only one of its kind in Missouri, and it was an old, it's in a resort kind of area, and so it's an old motel with cabins. So everybody has their own individual cabin, which means they have their own little kitchenette, their own bedroom. I mean, it's all, they can actually do whatever they need to do from that. They don't have to share that with anybody. And to me, that's just an incredibly unique situation. So some of the things around communal living, that program up front admits they're very, very fortunate that they don't have to deal with some things, but they still have some of the same issues that other programs were telling us. So we agreed at the coalition to sponsor those meetings. We paid for mileage. We paid for lunch to get folks here. We met initially about every month, every other month. We also had conference calls.
We had a listserv.
Yes. Yeah. And so it was, for the first year, it was a lot of contact. The coalition, if the programs, all they needed to agree, give us a year with this and really be willing to examine your rules, bring those to the meetings, and the coalition would then provide ongoing training and technical assistance.
And programs even did who was coming to the meeting a little different. Some programs, it was just their administrator or executive director. There's at least one program who would also end up bringing one of their advocates with them. But they would come and they would talk about what they've been doing to implement, where maybe they had struggles. They would brainstorm and be able to talk about what was effective. And I know we'll talk more about it in the next call, but it was one of those big lessons learned about how important the buy-in is of the whole program and how to make sure everybody feels like they really have a voice in that process, which is part of why we ended up doing a survey with advocates from the programs at different points during the process, since not everybody from the programs were coming to the meetings, that they could still share their experience about what it was like.
Gosh, I think it's so great that you tried so hard to intentionally be inclusive of your entire state. And so picking one program from each of your seven regions and getting a mix of urban and rural, I think that well thought out process is really, really nice to see. So I'm glad that that was a part of your initial thinking. So tell us how you pulled this off. Like how did the actual implementation go after you started connecting with each other?
You know, initially, well, first, I do want to say that the programs that participated in this, there's no way we could have worked with them or they could have worked with us if the relationships between coalition staff and programs, our member programs, hadn't already been established. Because they had to trust that they could come to our offices, have these meetings, and air sometimes some things that didn't always feel good. You know, some of the rules that they still had that, by God, they wanted to get rid of, but they just didn't know how to do it. And some practices that they just were like, oh, I hate this one, but, you know, this is what we've done, you know, kind of thing. And they had to trust that we weren't going to be punitive with that. And I will say, because I know in some states this is not the case, in Missouri, we are not a pass-through of dollars coalition. So that changes our role a little bit.
And we don't certify. So it is, people really view us as the technical assistance provider. And so that also helped in that process. And programs, we also, we didn't have, you know, one way that we asked them to complete it. So programs really came up with how they wanted to go back and start to implement a third program. You know, we had some staff who said, I really want to try no rules and see what happens. We had others who said, well, I'm going to go back and have a process with our staff of fully going through the rules and then see how much we can comb down. And that was a very incremental process throughout, you know, the year. So they had different ways of going back, which also created learning lessons. Again, that's where we found that staff buy-in and explanation and philosophy and training and supervising is so critical, because if you don't have staff who truly believe in this and buy into it, you almost have a little bit of a rebellion with the project. They don't like it, they don't want to do it, and they feel like they can't do anything. And then that's not really the intention behind this. So we spent a lot of time in that brainstorming how they could talk to staff about it, how they could work through different issues, how when staff feel like something that defined their job is being taken away, what you can give them instead.
And we also, in the How the Earth Didn't Fly into the Sun publication, there are several sections in which there are lists of, if you want to start this conversation with staff in the organization, here's some sample questions of where to start. Here's how to work on, you know, getting everybody's feedback and how to maintain change. There's so much in that publication that's not just about how do you reduce rules, but really even how do you go about starting to even talk about it. Where do you actually start with things?
Well, and I love one of our participants at one point had said when they first out, they found out that they couldn't mandate folks to support group, she really had kind of a negative attitude about it and wasn't sure what to do. Again, she felt like, well, that's how I've always talked about it. I've always said, you know, here's when support group is. I'll see you then. You have to come to be able to stay in shelter. And she realized when they first changed, nobody was coming. And her first thought was, see, you know, the project doesn't work. And then she started having some internal reflection and realized, what if I change the way I talk about it? What if I try to have food? What if I try to get topics that they want to talk about? What if I start to talk about, you know, positive things that people who have attended have said about it? And when she realized, when she totally changed the way she talked about support group and how she offered it, that people started coming and it no longer needed to be required anymore. And it was really eye-opening for her to realize it had to do with how she had been approaching it and talking to folks about it.
So a couple of the things that have kind of come to mind are also around the way that I think we looked at this is it truly did kind of become a support group, too, for the participating programs. They really could talk about their challenges and found out they probably had more similarities than differences. The other piece of it that I looked at in our role, you know, and going back to my own advocacy and thinking about woman-defined advocacy, I really kind of looked at this as program-defined advocacy. I couldn't tell them how to do this in their program. I don't work in their program. I could only support and do the technical assistance and training that was possible. But each program had to do this in a way that made sense for the, you know, their staff makeup, their program, you know, all of those things. The other thing that came out of this were some interesting conversations around how. And I don't think, well, I don't think that this actually was in the forefront of my mind, and it really bothers me that it wasn't. But what the conversation turned around in often was around, this is also a much more just, when we're talking about diversity and we're talking about anti-oppression, and we're talking about racism, this is a way for, well, I'll just be blunt, honest. I'm from Missouri. We tend to be blunt. As a white middle-class woman, it was that's where the rules were based out of. That's where our practices and policies were based out of. And when we have, you know, primarily the leadership of organizations who the organization was started by primarily white women, it's continued to have that kind of leadership. Well, of course, I mean, it makes sense. Our rules, our policies, our practices were coming from that lens. And so this really became a bigger conversation around, oh, if we're working with somebody as an individual and we're really reducing the rules that have also come from that perspective, then, oh, my God, we've actually maybe tried to create some environments that were a lot more inclusive, that were much more culturally relevant. So I don't know. It was also one of those things that I just really hate to say that that was something I hadn't thought about up front. I mean, I'm embarrassed to say that, but it was something that the conversation turned that way very quickly of like, oh, this really may change some of how we can look at that as well and how we've been practicing and doing things. Hopefully that makes sense, what I'm saying.
Yeah, it makes total sense, and I think that's a really important point to bring up is the way in which you ultimately organize this project, I think, is really fascinating. And a part of, I think, a big takeaway for all of us is in how you designed and implemented it, where programs really got to talk about the realities of what will work for them, what their current struggles are, who they are, and who their community is, was reflective in how then you could support that thinking and that growing, which I think is a fabulous end result, because you can't fit everything for everybody in the same space. It's not the reality of any of our lives to match anybody else's life and
right.
their experience. So I think that's incredibly important, and I think that a piece of my takeaway out of that publication in particular is that you could really pull out just pieces and elements and think through what it means in the context of who you are as a program, who you are as a community, and think it through with the lens that you need to do. So I appreciate that you were brutally honest. I think that's helpful to really figure out what it is that this was born out of and where you took it and how you kind of recognized. So is there anything else that you want to share before we switch gears a little bit? But just in terms of that whole concept of really allowing programs to decide how to participate and what it was that got them to that place, because, you know, I mean, as you know, that one size fits all, that doesn't work.
Well, and
we know it doesn't.
I think the biggest thing was is that they were all open. They wanted so badly to make sure that they were doing the best possible work that could be done. They really, really wanted to have survivor-defined services. They wanted to be trauma-informed. You know, that empowerment model, you know, I mean, all of those things, and also be so much more inclusive. And really be inclusive. And so, you know, they were so open. So even though there might have, the pushback that was there was more around anxiety of like, oh my gosh, what happens when maybe I take this rule away? But they were willing to try. And it was about, though, the one thing that they all agreed upon was, can you minimize your rules? This was not... This was also not to be called the No Rules Project, which I get accused of by people, too. It's like, oh, yeah, that No Rules thing. It's like, that's not what it was. But it was about minimal rules to, you know, try and create hopefully the best possible atmosphere that we could with the least amount of rules. And how do we do that?
And having that space to look critically at it, some I know were able to start trying to build that into their programs, but that part part of why coming to the coalition and meeting with others was important. And part of what you're trying to do with the Advocacy Learning Center is so often when we've got huge caseloads and we've got such high amount of needs, we don't have that time to really step away and think, would I ideally want to be doing this, or it's just what I know. And so having that space to really step away is so important to allow that growth and really trying to come up with different ideas for how to handle situations rather than the way we've always done it.
All right, we have a question. Shane, I'm wondering if you could put, I don't know, a question or a comment or a thought, but somebody has raised something that they want to bring up, so I'm wondering if we could put them through an unmuted line.
Yes, it comes from Starting Point, and their line is open.
Great, thanks. Hello, welcome.
Hello. We thought we had done something wrong, so we were waiting here.
Did you mean to wait there?
So we were talking about when we went in New Hampshire, when we were looking at this project, because I heard people say that they got anxiety from it, and I was really excited by it because I had worked at the agency for 8 years, and I could really see that the rules were about preventing something that had happened in the past from happening again. But the thing that I think was the most powerful is that we had to abide by our own rules when we went to the training about changing shelter rules, and we had to, we were in essence treated as a client with some rules that were a combination of everything from around the state. And so then when we got into the training, we started to talk about how that experience was. And one of the things that was really interesting, there was two directors there, and they wouldn't sign the agreement to come in to the training. And I lied, which I don't ever lie, because I had medication that I wasn't willing to give up. And so we had these experiences that we could talk about in a different way. And I thought that that's really what energized us in this process, was for us to kind of have this reflection experience as we started the conversation. And I really encourage, we've done it with other shelter guests and other staff members now when we talk about rules, and I think it's one of those really powerful training tools that helps this process.
Absolutely. We've had a trainer in the past who would have folks have to turn in their cell phones, you know, do all those things very similar to what you're talking about. We did our documenting our work project, we collected intakes from across the state, and then my COO completed it with me, and before we started, she had to agree that I wasn't going to get fired if I was really honest with what it was like to answer those questions and to be honest in answering them. And sometimes, you know, those things that we're so familiar with, it does feel very different when we actually experience it ourselves, and it gives a lot of great insight. So that's a wonderful tip to be able to share.
Thank you very much for sharing. Do you have any, before we move on, did you have any other reflections or outcomes of your exploration in your state?
So we only have three rules at shelter. So when we started the process, we had 24, and we changed it to three, and we changed our terminology to guidelines. So there's a document about expectations and rights for individuals that are working with us. And I think that what we've noticed is, or what I've noticed in this process of doing this, so it's been a 7 years that we've been doing this process, and I say that it's still a process that continues because we're always reflecting back what's not reflected in our work that we need to do now, and we've done some trauma-informed work, and we've revised our manual again. So instead of looking at, like, the shelter rules as something that we had to get done and that they're set in stone, this process has really taught us about reviewing them on a, you know, at least an every 6 month basis, and what do we need to change. If something needs to get changed beforehand, then we do that change. We don't wait until, you know, the next time we're going to revise them all. We really try to keep it as a living, breathing document within the agency. But I think the thing that's been the challenge as the director is that if people don't have the perspective of where the project came from, that it can be really hard to not fall into that relationship of the parent role, and that can be the biggest challenge for shelter managers who don't have the perspective of how the project came to be, because it is that it's an easier relationship than necessarily really working with somebody in that collaborative approach of how this individual is going to work through their homelessness issue. And so I think that it just required us to think differently, or me as the director to think differently.
Very good. Thank you so much for sharing. Jennifer, Laura, before we have starting point, back in the muted line, did you have anything you wanted to ask or share based on their?
Just when we talk about like empowerment model, that it's not only just about the individuals we're serving, it's also with staff, that this should be something that we're trying to build them up as much as possible. And that I love the way she talked about it's an ongoing process, sort of like implementing our own self-care strategies. You know, it's not this one-time, you know, thing that you do and you move on. It's got to be an ongoing part of our conversations. And, you know, the one of the programs that struggled the most with this was because their ED loved the idea so much and went back and mandated it on their staff. And it wasn't very empowering for the staff. And so this really should be about all of us feeling like we're growing and feeling more competent and having skills and being able to really work through our angst and feeling like we're really explaining that philosophy behind it, both to residents who maybe don't understand or to staff who don't understand. And that philosophical buy-in is so critical. And to keep going back to it anytime we start kind of getting stuck in the daily difficulties.
So another thing that came out of one of the first meetings that we had with the programs, too, around how they wanted to implement this for themselves was one of the directors, who normally is not quiet, sat almost the entire meeting and said nothing. And I'm thinking, oh, great, she's mad. But she said, you know, I'm listening and I keep hearing, you know, our resident handbooks, our rules, our guidelines, all this stuff. She goes, I don't know why we ever actually truly came up with a resident handbook with rules in it. She said, why don't we have an advocacy handbook? Why do we continue to give people, you know, who are coming in that we're going to provide services to, why do we keep giving them something about what we should expect from them? Why don't we give them something about what they should expect from us? I mean, we're the ones that are supposed to be providing services. And that really also made people really stop and think about, oh, what would that look like if it really was about us giving advocates those kinds of tools to be able to, you know, if these kinds of things are happening, here's some different things to think about. And, you know, how can we, you know, use that kind of philosophy too. So, so that was another, as the caller was asking the question too and talking about that, that was something else that came up of just, you know, how do we approach that?
Yeah, so you couldn't have written it better, and maybe we should use your language the next time we start talking through the core principles of the ALC. But really, that's exactly how it fits within all of our conversations, and how this has bubbled up in the Advocacy Learning Center for us is that, you know, we come from this place of having these core principles that we talk through about how is it that we're living and breathing these core principles, about creating experience that is liberating versus dominating, and trying to figure out the person's reality and their actual needs versus what our kind of institutional needs are. So, you know, all of those places are where the rub is sometimes. Because it does, the reality of having very structured roles, your example of the staff person who didn't have a lot of direction or a lot of training, got a hold of the staff rules and said, well, this is a good place to start. I mean, that's not an unusual story or an experience of advocates across the country, and so rules can very easily be this place where there's no gray. It's either this or this, and sometimes when we don't have this way in which we support each other and figure this out and create kind of this liberating experience rather than a dominating experience, that's the end result, right? Like,
well, and we have got to figure out a way of supporting, and I know we will talk maybe a little bit more about this too on the next call, but we've got to figure out a way organizationally to truly support each other, to support staff, because I also don't want anybody that ever hears this or reads this publication or anything else to think that I don't remember what it was like to work an overnight with the hotline ringing, a baby with 104 fever, the toilets clogged up, there's a somebody waiting at the door that the police have just brought in for shelter. I have, you know, three people then that have just woken up from night terrors. And, I mean, I don't want anybody to think that we ever go through this and go, this is easy. But this is about how do we support each other and how can we actually create those environments that really do support each other, but also support the women and children that are coming through those doors.
Yeah, I think that you're exactly right. We do have to do a better job of figuring out how to nurture and care for all of us in this work together. Because the end result will be that we'll nurture and care for all of us as human beings eventually. And that's the end game, right? Like, that's where we want to get to. Yeah. We had a comment that I wanted to give you a chance to talk through a little bit before we moved on, but I'll just read it. But I wonder if you found a bit more resistance to shelter rules by women of color or Native women. I ask because I think it seems that more marginalized women are, the more they would resist. If it feels just like another form of oppression above and beyond what they experience by living with a batterer's control tactics. And I know you touched on it just a little bit, but I think...
So I would say that, you know, we've had mixed feedback. I can't say it has been one way or the other. What I have found is that we're having more conversations, though. We're having more conversations around racism and oppression. And again, like I, you know, kind of was talking about earlier as far as where rules come from and if it's been predominantly established by, you know, white middle class, you know, women. But what we found is that the more and more people, though, women of color, are reporting that, you know, it's still a situation, though, in which, you know, I have to be seen as an individual, which, and so I think that there's more positive than negative that's come out of it. Again, I think we're having more and more conversations around how this becomes a more inclusive environment. And we already know that within the movement itself, often it's women of color who, you know, there is one on staff, you know, one woman of color on staff. And we find that there's a whole, yeah, I mean, there's a high turnover in this, but that there is probably more turnover when you have women of color on staff. A lot of our programs, quite honestly, in parts of our state, residents coming in are going to be primarily white. And again, we have started having more and more conversations about what that means for that program when we absolutely know the percentage of, you know, women of color in their area, the population, or women who, you know, have limited English proficiency, or, you know, I mean, all of those things. You know, if you're not white, if you don't speak English, or if you're undocumented, kind of thing. But so, yeah, I don't know that I have an easy answer because I think that it's an ongoing conversation, and I've heard both. I mean, I've heard report. I've talked with women and from programs who have heard both negative and positives. So I hope that that's not like trying to get an easy out on that, because I don't think that's an easy question, and I don't think that that's a one-time conversation. I think that has to be ongoing conversations.
Yeah, I agree. Ongoing. I wonder, you know, how you organized your project and just your intention of trying to get a variety of voices and different programs within this project. And I know you said that for the first year you guys were meeting all the time and there was listserv and just all of you were kind of infused in your conversations together. And I wonder if there are any things that you could pull out of that experience of being with programs across your state for a year, of how you were able to infuse each other's experience and the ways in which you were able to take and listen to each other and account for different experiences and different realities?
You know, I'm going to say that's kind of a difficult question. Jennifer's given me a puzzled look too, because how we've established just across the board in our own practice here at the Coalition is that we are constantly, even if it's not a specific project, but that's just what we do. I mean, we are constantly working around the state on things. And so as far as them being able to share and us being able to incorporate all those kinds of things, I mean, it just, boy, I don't know that I even thought about it that much, because that's just how we do things around here.
Yeah, one thing that was interesting, though, about the project was because it is pretty intensive, we had only selected one program from each region when we first started, and then there were these initial rumors, and people were upset, and then it became programs saying, well, no, we want to be a part of it,
yeah,
too. And so then we had a phase two, and honestly, that we no longer have an actual project where people are coming here, but we just regularly get phone calls, and either we're answering them or we're redirecting them to programs who have been a part of it, or we're referring to the manual. So it's just been this constant part of, this is like anything else. It's like talking about hotline. It's talking about support group. It's any service that we're providing. How do we share about best practices? How do we help connect them to individuals? Maybe have conversations with multiple people. It's just been really interesting that people just wanted that space to be able to come together and to talk to others.
And this, and maybe, I don't think I said this up front, this project, the official project, started in 2007. So it really, that first year were those seven programs, and then after that they were like, no, we want to bring more people on too, along with those people that are asking. So then we added like eight or nine more, and then met for that next year after that. But once that was over, those initial first 2 years, we actually weren't meeting formally anymore. It really just, it kind of took on a life of its own.
Yeah, and we looked at how we train on it different. I know Laura does our Nature and Dynamics of Domestic Violence training, and there's an afternoon really talking about rules, but it's that way that creates buy-in and understanding, so that we can approach the conversations different than we had in the past. And we end up using a lot of the examples from our programs. That's part of why that conversation becomes so important, is because you're able to use the examples that you've heard and then brainstorm. You know, there's the suggestion about an advocate rule book, we had been so excited about the idea until we realized there are so many different scenarios. You can't write a scenario for every single thing that you're going to experience. Like every time I think I've heard it all, I get another call and I'm like, okay, I got to think through that one a little bit more. But it's having that philosophy and having the skills to be able to problem solve around it.
Yeah, I mean, that's how we've kind of come to this. I talked about the core principles, but that's really it, is having this strong foundation of why we do what we do, so that we can be coming from more of a place of, if we have this foundation and this is what we believe and this is how we do what we do, then we don't have to have an answer for absolutely everything, because we can draw upon, this is why we exist, this is what we do, and this is why we do it. And then you can insert almost anything that comes before you as not a new thing, but as a way to reframe it, to say, this is what supports me in being the best advocate possible.
And I think where it also got a lot of kind of I don't know if momentum is the right word, but when advocates really started getting it and started seeing the changes, then that excited other advocates too. You know, when people started saying this made me a better advocate, I started feeling so much more successful. I felt like I was really connecting with people. You know, I was able to have more real and genuine conversations. I think that that generated a lot of energy too around that. People, I mean, that's why people got into this.
Exactly. Yeah, I think it is. It's this contagious energy that starts to happen once you kind of give permission to talk about it differently and to give a chance to be back to kind of the basics of why we do what we do and why we've come to this work. And as a result, you know, then we all have this moment of freedom to say, this is why we do this work, this is why we're in the movement, this is why we're doing it, and as a result, these are our principles, and this is how we do it, our core activities of being able to connect with people and spend time and engage in dialogue and really take time to strategize with women instead of for women, and all of those pieces just happen with such force, you know, all of a sudden it just kind of comes upon you, and it's exciting, and it feels good. I'm going to stop myself for just a second to see if there's any questions. So I realized we went a really long time without
offering up. Time.
There's none. Okay, same. Thanks. I don't feel quite so guilty, but please, please push star one if you feel like you want to jump in and share in our energy, because as you can see, we could probably talk about this for hours and hours if we only had the luxury of staying on the phone together for hours and hours. That would be lovely. You know, when as soon as you said 2007 is when you started this project, I, in the back of my mind, I think I knew that, but I didn't connect it. But when Anne was releasing their study, that came out like a full year after you started this project.
I know.
So, so I'm just wondering if there, once you had this study hot in your hands, was there anything that really rang true for you? Your realities and your experience and your conversations were reflected kind of in what women were saying about their experience in shelter. Kind of how did that come together after kind of 12 months of digging deep into it?
Yeah, well, it was so cool when that came, when the research came out. I think I probably danced around the office going, look, it's evidence-based kind of thing. But it really, it did truly, truly reinforce that, okay, this was not some harebrained idea that we had had, that this really was now not just from advocates, but now from survivors too, that were saying, and I know Anne explained it too, there are so many pieces of that research, but there is a section that really does deal with rules. And the funny part was, as I read through it, it's the same rules we continue to have problems with. It's rules around chores. It's rules around supervising children. And at the basic level, what came out in that study too was like, oh, well, then it doesn't matter where we are. These are some of the same things we continue to have problems with. It supported what we were doing. It supported what programs definitely were talking about, and it was nice. Yeah, it was just really nice to go, look, there is research to back this up.
And I remember, it's been several years, but when we first started having a lot of examples from our project and started going out and doing more on-site trainings with our members, I did a training on it, and there was a woman in the room who had just been hired on, and she spoke so eloquently, and she was really nervous to do so since she was just newly hired, but she had actually come from another state where she had stayed in a shelter, and she had lied, and she had lied a lot because their rules were so hard for her to follow. And you could just feel the energy in the room change when she started telling how they had made her feel and how difficult it was for her to follow. And so that also, when people are hearing that, that sort of, you know, qualitative experience about that wasn't the intention. And then the other thing with the chores is, because that is one of the big ones that come up, is, you know, also is keeping in mind that there are a lot of, like, classism issues that end up coming up about expectations of people who are coming in and getting shelter, and shouldn't they be doing things to earn being here versus this is a service that we just offer them, you know, and if any sort of things need to be done, that's our role as staff, or we can provide incentives for individuals. But there's a lot of issues around expectations of what we expect for people to get the services that we're offering them, and really being able to look through that, because some of it we found tend to be, you know, different ideas that sometimes tie into classism.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you so much for sharing that, because I think that reminding ourselves to keep women's voices in all of our work, in every aspect of our work, and to be a part of that work with us is incredibly important and yet too often forgotten. And so I think that that was kind of Anne's contribution to all of us struggling with this project and everyone involved in that study. But it was this huge reminder for us all to hear what women are saying and mm-hmm. respond to it. And you know, it's a humbling reminder sometimes when we get on kind of a steamroller and a lot of energy behind it to remind us sometimes that we don't do a great job of that, unfortunately, all the time. So, but again, I think Laura, you said it really well, is that we also have to figure out a way to support each other in all of this work collectively. And I think when we go to that kind of phase of getting ready to figure that out once and for all, or at least start the conversation in a really big way, I think we have to be reminded of how we can be completely inclusive of what that means for all of us. So thanks. I have gotten a gentle nudge to say that we have a question in the queue. Yay! So Shane, can you pop them through?
Yes, it comes from the NDCAWS. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Courtney from the Council on Abused Women Services in North Dakota.
Hi, Courtney.
Hi, how are you?
Lovely. Lovely to be with you.
I am wondering, you know, you talked about one of the rules that you guys continue to struggle with is chores. I chair our shelter committee for the state, for all of our shelters in the state, and one of the rules that continually comes up for us is alcohol and substance abuse issues. And I know that that's not anything new for me to say, but we've had a significant population increase in the last couple of years. And we've also seen with that a lot of problems that come along with that. We have had an increase in synthetic drug use in our shelters, as well as prescription drug abuse issues. So, you know, we have our shelters are constantly struggling with, you know, what can they do, the issues around regulating that kind of stuff, you know, and it's just kind of a constant struggle with trying to find a balance with how to address those situations. And then the other question I wanted to bring up, there are two very different topics, but this one has just kind of come up recently, is that around firearms in the shelters. One of our local programs was wondering, North Dakota is a very, very gun-friendly
state. Hey, so we are here in Missouri. Yay.
Right, that's why I wanted to bring this up now, because you guys are perfect. We need some help, but we got asked, you know, we're the whole stand, we have the whole stand your ground business, and, you know, people are allowed to bring their firearms to, you know, have them in their vehicles at work, and concealed weapons permits are being handed out left and right. I guess that's maybe a little exaggerated, but we've definitely seen an increase in that kind of stuff. So our problem is, you know, how do we address, you know, not having firearms in our shelters, basically. So I was really looking for any kind of information that you guys might have or policy examples and things. So because
I'm assuming you don't have lock boxes or the individuals coming don't have a way to lock up their weapons?
You know, some of the shelters have lockers, some of them don't. And also, I don't know how the – well, first of all, I mean, if you have a concealed weapon and it's truly concealed, honestly, they probably won't even know that you have it. But what we're concerned about, since this is an emerging issue, is that some of these shelters are going to come up with a knee-jerk response. You know, like, oh, we've got to create a policy around this because somebody was at a training and saw somebody with a concealed weapon, and what are we going to do? So we better create a policy. So because, you know, policies, you know, by shelter policies don't ever start like that.
Sure. No. Well, and so...
Because somebody did something once upon a time ago, you know, so...
Right. And so North Dakota, you realize Central Time is 3:19 and we end at 3:30, and you just asked two amazingly excellent and complicated questions. So, no. And when I was talking about chores being a common one, that's just still a common one. In
you
Missouri,
do, definitely.
But please don't misunderstand. I mean, in Missouri, as far as drugs and alcohol, mental health issues, those are huge. And I will, and yes, and the numbers of people that are coming in with substance use issues seem to be just bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. Boy, I don't know that we have, and I think that that's part of this too. There's not one, I don't think, answer to this. I think what it comes around to initially, though, in response to, let's start with the substance use issue, is that people really think about, is it reasonable to expect someone who might be alcohol or drug dependent to just abstain simply because they walk through your doors? Mm-hmm. We have to ask ourselves that, if that's our expectation. Because if that's our expectation, we will never find a way to truly be able to partner and work with a woman with substance use issues. Because that's not a reasonable expectation. So it's how do we talk about it? How do we have conversation around making it okay for her to be able to talk about it and for us to be open to listen to it and to be willing to work with her on it? And just because I use substances doesn't mean necessarily that I'm an addict or necessarily that I need to go to rehab or even think I might need to, kind of thing. So, I mean, there's a lot of those. What are our expectations around women who use substances? And so I would really, truly refer you to, if you want some really good information on that, is Patty Bland's information. You can get it on, I think some of it's still on the Washington State
Alaska
website and Alaska website, Alaska Coalition website.
She's one of our keynote presenters at our conference in October. So.
She's wonderful. I give her credit, but I steal from her often.
Mm-hmm.
And one of it is how we start a conversation around substance use, say, with somebody. And that's with anybody. We shouldn't wait until we suspect she's got a problem or we think she's using or misusing or whatever. It needs to start up front, including talking with people about, you know, diversity within the shelter and, you know, people coming from different walks of life and religion and beliefs and blah, blah, blah. You know, we provide services to any number of people. And they're also going to have any number of issues. You know, so many people are coming from crisis situations. Some people may have substance abuse issues. Some people may be in recovery. I mean, we need to be up front with people who are coming in for services anyway. But some of the questions or some of the conversation also needs to start just by saying, you know, it's been my experience that a lot of women have used substances just to try and cope with what's been going on in their lives. If this is something that you want to talk more about or you think you might be having challenges with, we want to talk with you about it. Here are some other resources that could be available to you. But it's not even making the judgment of, I assume you use. It's just making it normal for people to be able to talk about it.
and that they haven't heard from someone else who disclosed that they were instantly asked to leave, that the program worked with them, because that word of mouth can be really powerful too.
Now, that doesn't take away that people are going to use. And so I do think when you say as far as, you know, are there, you don't just want to create some more policy, I do think that, I don't want to say that I'm not for some policy, because that's not, but I do think it is, it's how staff respond. It's, are there, you know, like Jennifer was talking about even with the weapons, but like their own individual kind of lock boxes, you know, are we explaining to people that if there's something of value that you want, and, you know, something of value could be their prescription medications,
mm-hmm.
but if you want to lock, you know, people come, you know, if you're leaving something out, you know, somebody might potentially steal it or take it or whatever. I mean, so it's, are we giving people those types of options where they can lock things up? You know, that's like a very, I don't know, that's just one of the things that pops up. But no, that is an ongoing thing. But it's really how staff responds and what options that we're giving for women to be able to talk with us about those things, to lock up weapons. We would have people that brought weapons in. We up front said, you know, we asked that you don't have any weapons in your room. We had people turning stuff over to us. We locked it up. And, you know, when they left, they could take that with them. But we tried really hard. We tried really, really hard not to put any judgment of, like, because, I mean, she might, the gun, the knife, whatever it is, that may be something that is making her feel really safe right now. And so I don't want to just take that away from somebody without talking and explaining.
Right.
And
strategizing, because this is communal living, and
yeah.
there's other people, or there's people's kids, or we might try to be able to reduce the likelihood of them coming into their room, but they may. So what are ways that we can keep that so that other people wouldn't unintentionally harm themselves or somebody else with it? I mean, I know with small firearms, there are individual boxes you can buy to lock them up, just like with travel. So there might be a variety of options, but being transparent, that's one of the big things with any of this, is being transparent
yeah.
about it. So there's no, like, hidden intention, and that can help with that conversation about, because it's communal living, that, and you can't control another person's behavior, that, you know, you just want that person to be thinking through, if they're bringing these things into the facility, what are ways that they can do so, you know, safely.
And there's, you know, the other piece of that, too, is that either you need to be transparent with it, I think, or your other option is, what are you going to, are you going to pat people down when they come through? Are you going to go through all their things? I mean, and that definitely feels yucky, and I wouldn't want anyone to do that to me, you know, kind of thing. So, I mean, I think it is about, there's an element of, we do the best we can. And I don't want that to sound like just some offhanded remark, but we really do. We have communal living situations. We are working with people that are coming in from all walks of life and different beliefs. And the one common denominator is they've come to us for help. And so how can we try, yeah, how can we try and be as upfront with people and give them as many options and many ways to maybe safely try and store things in those situations, or I don't know. I hope that's helpful. I feel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was, thanks, Courtney. You hit the heart of two really tough questions, and so thanks, Jennifer and Laura. But
thank you. No, I'm just kidding. No,
yeah.
I'm glad you asked that, though, because that, yeah.
No, it is really good. And the good news is we still have a whole another session that we will carry on this topic with. Our third session is in September, so we can take this up, and we will take this up. Our plan is to just keep digging in deeper and deeper. So thanks, Courtney, and you've proven that we probably needed five or six sessions, not three, but at least this isn't the third, and we still will take this on. The time is ticking, and so one final just thought, or to put it out there, I think for us when we grapple in shelters with rules and as they bubble up, and we're challenged by a lot of things that will come up. You brought up two big examples, and there are a couple of more examples that we could also bring up at this last hour, but in the last minute. But I think what we also have to take up and consider, and this can be really tricky and it can be really hard, but we all carry our own fears and assumptions about certain things. And that plays a huge part into how we respond to particular things. So we may have staff who are incredibly uncomfortable with substance abuse, or brings up a lot of uncomfortable places for them or moments, or they have a lot of assumptions about what that means when people use. And that gets muddled in all of this. And you can put all of that into, you know, any example, but all of what we carry as human beings gets all garbled up in it, and we do have to start pulling it out and figuring out how that impacts our work, how it impacts our organization, and then what do we do with all of that. So it's not an easy task, but I think all too often we don't, and so then it starts bubbling up in weird, odd places. So there's where we are at the end of our time together. So I just want to take a couple of minutes to thank Jennifer and Laura so very much for being on this call with us, and all of the callers and all of you who listened and got all revved up like I did when we were talking about this. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
Yeah.
And we're looking forward to the next call.
Yay, good.
We'll be on Laura's
birthday.
That's right. My birthday is September 5th on the next call. So I can send out an address of where you can send me. No, I'm kidding.
Just write this down.
Perfect. Thanks. So thanks for spending your birthday with us next week.
You're welcome.
So we will on September 5th, so mark your calendars. That is when we will carry on the next part of this conversation. And we do have a few additional announcements that I want to give Liz time to share with us before we wrap up the call. But thank you for all of you for sharing your time with us today. We really appreciate it. Liz?
I'm here. So the next time that we will all be together after the affinity call on September 5th, Laura's birthday. And
thank you, Liz.
When we all come together to eat cake independently in your honor, we'll be Wednesday, October 16th. That will be our keynote conversation, so discussion. So make sure that it is on your calendar so you're sure not to miss it. And you know how we are at the ALC. We love evaluations. It's so important to the programming that we do to help us determine what is working and what might not be working so much. So be sure that when this evaluation pops into your inbox momentarily, that you spare just 3 minutes to tell us your thoughts about this call and ideas about what you think about it and future topics, and we appreciate it. So that's all I have, Beth.
Great. Thank you so much. And my last little request beyond doing your evaluation is if you have things that have bubbled up in your minds, your thoughts, as you go on with your team and carry out some conversations as a result of this call, if you could email those to me, because we do still have time to reshape and reformat our thinking around this, our third session together. So if there are things that you want to make sure we can incorporate, we will try very hard to pull those in as a part of the call organizing. So please send them to me, advocacy@praxisinternational.org. So with that, I will leave you all and have a fabulous day. Have a fabulous rest of the week and weekend. And until next time,
thank
goodbye,
you.
Everybody.